Laughing as we age, a dual nurse engineer career for some nurses, doubling the number of elderly patients, and we'll look at difficult end-of-life decisions and nurses' roles in organ donation. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, the podcast for nurses by nurses. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to go ahead and thank you for checking out the show this week. First up in this week's nursing news items, we're going to find out about how you can help your elderly patients maintain their memory with a bit of humor. Then, in a special interview segment this week, I bring you a chat with a nurse involved in end-of-life decisions surrounding potential organ donation. That's coming up later on in this week's episode of The Nursing Show, so stay tuned. Before we get to the news, though, I'd like to make sure you are following up on all of the information you get from this and all of our episodes here by heading over to nursingshow.com. When you get there, check out the links in each episode's show notes. There are other articles, too, links to things like the free Nursing Show mobile app for your phone, student nurse tips, and a lot of other things. But I want you to make sure you're following up on the information so that you know how what I talk about in the show each week can be applied to your own nursing scope of practice, or not. If you want to get back in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. Please drop me an email. You can send those emails in to me directly to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from you, and I make sure I respond back to every email that comes in. So send me things like links to news items you'd like me to cover. Maybe you have an idea for a topic for a future episode or an interview suggestion. Whatever the case may be, please keep those emails coming. That's it. I'll have some more contact information coming up later on in this episode, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's news items, coming right up. First up in this week's news, let's take a look at an article on humor and the mental health of senior citizens I found over at healthday.com. A new study from researchers at Loma Linda University in California looked at the effects of the stress hormone cortisol on aging patients' memory and mental acuity. They studied the possibility that laughter might lower the effects of cortisol on these seniors. Two groups of senior citizens were shown a funny 20-minute video, and then they were tested on their memory and mental acuity as well as cortisol levels. Then we compared this to tests on a group who did not see the funny video. The subjects who saw the video were found to score better on memory tests and had lower cortisol levels, suggesting that regular exposure to funny and humorous things can improve memory and mental state in senior citizens. The study was presented recently at the Experimental Biology Conference in San Diego. Now, one of the authors summed up the research saying, quote, "It's simple. The less stress you have, the better your memory." This doesn't mean that we need to be comedians in the midst of our patient care, but it does point to the core nursing tenet that when we treat the whole patient, we manage their overall health better. So make sure your hospitals have access to humorous videos or movies in their in-house TV system. Maybe even share a suggested funny YouTube video. It has to be appropriate, of course, but you might want to share that with some of your patients or their families. When appropriate, you could even open up your patient interactions with a simple joke. Maybe a "why did a chicken cross the road" joke could be a precursor to a better patient interaction in the future. Let's check that out in a future episode. Next up in the nursing news this week is a look at how one college is focusing on those nurses out there with a technology bent to their interests. Duquesne University in Pittsburgh has all sorts of nursing specialties already there with programs for nurse anesthetists, nurse practitioners, and nurse managers, but now they're offering a specialized nursing dual major for nurse engineers. The 5-year program will combine the nursing BSN program with a biomedical engineering degree. The hope of the program's founders is actually to create biomedical engineers with the practical, hands-on clinical background of nurses. The newly created nurse engineers will be what organizers call force multipliers for patient care technology, since the practical clinical focus of nursing combined with the technical understanding of an engineer may well revolutionize how medical devices and products are designed. Nurses have long been part of improvements to streamline and improve the efficiency of healthcare, and this goes all the way back to the work of Florence Nightingale and beyond. Now, as technology continues to become more and more prevalent in the healthcare arena, nurses can take their place in making this new wave of healthcare devices more efficient and focused on better patient care. The program is fully accredited. It has been blessed by both the Pennsylvania Board of Nursing and the Collegiate Commission on Nursing, and the necessary accreditation from the Board of Engineering and Technology is expected to be approved soon. So if you're looking for something different in the realm of nursing education, you might want to consider a degree as a nurse engineer. Finally, in this week's news, let's take a look at a recent report on the steadily aging population I found over at healthday.com. The U.S. Census Bureau released a new report on the prospective number of elderly patients in the United States by 2050, and it doesn't look like we're going to get a break anytime soon. According to the report, the number of elderly patients we can expect to have on hand will more than double by 2050, meaning that we'll need even more healthcare workers and professionals, like nurses, to manage them. The effects are not only going to be on healthcare, but also on businesses and politics. Family structures will change, and we can expect to see more extended families living together in support of an elderly parent or grandparent. There are going to be a higher ratio of retirees to people in the workforce, and it may mean that more people will work until later in life, putting off retirement until well after 65. This can increase work-related injury and stress in elderly patients, so it's going to be a lot of interesting things out there. The U.S. is actually going to be one of the younger populations as we continue to have a higher birth rate than other industrialized nations, which have seen population level off or even decline as young families put off having children. The important thing is that we, as nurses, have to continue to inspire new nurses for the healthcare system's continued needs. Keep your eyes on the opening for that promising young person out there and nudge them towards a career in nursing. You might be needing them sometime down the road for yourself or for somebody you love. In this week's Tip of the Week, we have the first of our special segments recorded at the American Association of Critical Care Nurses, AACN, conference in Denver last week. Thanks to the generous support of Physiocontrol, I was able to get to this conference and interview some of the top nurse researchers and leaders in the critical care arena. I get to bring those to you back here on The Nursing Show. In this segment from NTI, I chat with nurse researcher Rich Arbour, a transplant coordinator and critical care nurse from Rochester, New York. Rich talks about the nurse's role in preparing potential patient donors for and their families for end-of-life decisions involved in organ donation. So here's that segment with Rich. Hi, we're here with Rich Arbour at NTI 2014, and one of the things I really look forward to at these events is to get a chance to talk to some of the thought leaders, research experts in the field of critical care nursing. And Rich is certainly an expert in that sense with his leadership in organ donation and critical care approaches to managing the potential organ donor. Rich, before we get started on talking about those subjects, why don't you tell us a little bit about why you wanted to become a nurse to begin with?
Talk about an almost loaded question. Probably the main reason I wanted to become a nurse was, even from when I was a young boy, I always appreciated opportunities to help out, whether it's with something in the neighborhood or cleaning up after a natural disaster with, you know, helping out my family and my neighbors. And so having finishing up high school and then getting into college, realizing at the point where I had to make some of those initial life decisions about what direction you're going to go, realizing I like the sciences, which is a good fit with evidence-based and research-based practice, but I also really appreciated opportunities to help people to make make a difference, whether it's helping a patient recover or whether it's helping a patient's family be more at ease with what's going on or less fearful and developing that relationship which can help the patient recover after they're discharged.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how your career's progressed to where you are today as this research thought leader that you are.
Well, let's see, it started, I graduated in 1983 from an associate's degree program. I found that an excellent, excellent foundation. I got a terrific education. It was Luzerne County Community College in Nanticoke, Pennsylvania, which is in the Wyoming Valley, northeastern PA, where I grew up. And after finishing my time there, I had moved to Philadelphia and began working. I worked first for a year in the specialty area of MedSurg, and then I moved into a critical care environment after that year. And so that puts me approximately 30 years in critical care practice. It has been and continues to be challenging, very invigorating, sometimes very tiring, but every minute that I'm there with the patients, with my colleagues, working with student nurses, there is absolutely no place in the world I would rather be.
So tell us a little bit about your position as working with patients who are potential organ donors. That's got to be incredibly rewarding, but also challenging.
It is challenging for a couple of reasons. For one, you treat when a patient comes in through an emergency department and up to a critical care unit, they're not looked at as just a potential organ donor. They're looked at as somebody who can potentially recover. For instance, whether they come in with a stroke, whether they come in with traumatic brain injury, the absolute positive goal of care in that setting is to do everything possible using evidence-based practice, using best practices to give that patient with the appropriate and aggressive therapeutic modalities that we have available to treat their intracranial pathophysiology. And so that's the goal of care.
Take care of those patients and help them to survive if possible. But when you reach that point where you realize that their brain is not functioning at the point where it needs to be, you've helped develop some protocols that help nurses identify when that patient has reached that point where they become an organ donor.
Yes, in general, that's true. More specifically, I had with a number of my presentations at this NTI and at other NTIs, as well as in various hospital settings where I've done education on brain death protocols. More specifically, when the point is reached where the patient coming in with an injury, let's say it's traumatic brain injury, and their intracranial pathophysiology continues to progress down, continues to worsen. The intracranial pressure gets higher, it's unresponsive to therapy, and despite very aggressive therapy, very aggressive mechanism-based therapy to try to shrink the swollen brain, drain fluid from the ventricular system inside the brain, and to quiet down the brain metabolism, even despite those best efforts, if the neurologic exam continues to worsen and the patient loses final brainstem function as evidenced by loss of cough, gag, and corneal reflexes, and where the pupils of the eyes are fixed, dilated, and at midpoint and not responsive to light, that's the point at which it is appropriate to consider beginning a brain death protocol only after it's been established that the patient has an identifiable injury and when that patient's injury has progressed and has been refractory to very aggressive and evidence-based care.
Rich, what are some considerations, nursing considerations, that can be considered by a nurse once brain death has been declared or when that declaration is impending?
Some of the considerations have to do with the idea of good neurologic surveillance and good surveillance of the patient, because the physiology involved following terminal brainstem herniation, which is the point at which brainstem function is lost and the pupils lose their ability to constrict to light and there are fixed in midpoint within the orbit. Given the physiology of what's happening, there are at times a few confounding factors that can potentially confuse the brain death exam. Among those confounding factors are the possibility, doesn't occur in a majority of patients, but it can occur, and it can either delay or possibly abort a brain death protocol. One such confounding factor are the onset of possible spinal reflexes. They do not require, it can be an arm movement or a leg movement in response to a very localized stimulation or repositioning the patient in bed. For clinicians who are not familiar with that aspect of physiology in the setting of devastating and non-survivable brain injury that can cause someone to think that perhaps we're moving a little bit too quickly, when in fact the patient still can be brain dead. Another potential issue is how the patient's cardiovascular system can interact with a mechanical ventilator. With patients following terminal brainstem herniation, their cardiac cycle is much, much stronger and much more hyperdynamic than is baseline. That can cause the heart to move a little bit more strongly inside the chest, can move more blood volume with each systole and diastole, and that can cause compression and movement of sometimes compliant lung tissue. If the patient's ventilator is set too sensitive, meaning if it takes less perceived inspiratory effort to trigger a ventilator breath, that can cause the patient to auto-trigger or otherwise overbreathe the ventilator set rate in the setting of somebody who is actually dead by neurologic criteria. That can be confusing to the team, and if it is something that the bedside nurse or the physician team members are not as familiar with, it can cause them to have a little bit of confusion about a brain death determination.
I've heard it said that nurses are involved with the beginning steps of 95% or more of the organ donations that happen out there. Give us a little peek at why you think it's important for all nurses to have some education and knowledge about the organ donation process in their community and how to work with patients and families regarding this difficult decision.
Well, the reason it's important is I would tend to agree with you. It is a very, very high percentage of organ donation cases that begin with, often it's the bedside nurse. We're typically the discipline with the patient 24/7, 365, and it's that ongoing relationship with the patient and being tuned in and being able to recognize more quickly even very subtle changes in the examination, and recognizing when, despite our best efforts to try to maximize that individual patient's chance at a good recovery, recognizing when the patient's injury is refractory to that aggressive care. Often it is nursing that initiates a, let's say, as clinically appropriate, a referral to an organ procurement organization, and or telling other team members, such as physician team members, that this may be the appropriate time to begin a brain death protocol.
As we wrap up this interview, Rich, I always try to promote the conferences that I attend. And I always want to talk to the nurses that maybe have never been to a major conference in their specialty like this. What advice or what encouragement would you give to them as one of the benefits of coming to a conference like NTI offers to the nurse that attends?
Well, I think the benefits I could list, I'm not sure we have time for, because I will admit to a personal and professional bias, I think NTI is an outstanding conference. One of the benefits is you have an opportunity to be able to compare notes and exchange ideas with people in other practice settings. And I'm personally and professionally very big on anything that can encourage and that can cultivate one's creative process. For example, a number of years ago at my first NTI, I had an opportunity to have lunch with colleagues at a hospital in Houston, Texas. We were doing things one way, they were doing things another way, and we had an opportunity to exchange ideas that gave me inspiration to look at other projects to change and to improve practice in my home institution at that time. So it's an opportunity to network. You can make friends, make long-lasting relationships with colleagues at other centers around the country, but also internationally. Secondly, there is a great amount of knowledge that is available at this and similar conferences. For example, I just came from a conference, one of my colleagues who's known as an international expert in pulmonary care. I learned things from that, and I had the opportunity to exchange some ideas with her. Another opportunity is an outstanding professional development opportunity for people at their first NTI, the novice or the advanced beginner nurses. For example, they can see individuals who are teaching, some more senior individuals in critical care, and they can begin to look at that. They can begin to look at a lot of such individuals as role models to give them a sense of, that is one I want to work towards. That's a professional goal I want to strive towards. And those are among the many benefits of attending a conference like this NTI.
Well, Rich, thanks a lot for sharing some of your valuable time and some of your knowledge with the Nursing Show audience. And I want to thank all of you for taking some time to listen to what Rich has to say. Make sure you educate yourself about what goes on with critical care with your patients at all levels and all specialties, and also understand how organ donation may be something you need to get a little more education and knowledge about. You'll find more segments like this one over at nursingshow.com. In the meantime, please make sure you stay tuned to this channel for more from NTI 2014. All of the things that we're shooting here at NTI 2014 with the Critical Care Nurses Conference is brought to you through the generous support and sponsorship of Physio-Control. You know, I couldn't do it without them, and you need to understand that there's a lot of things that you could be doing to improve your CPR, improve your resuscitation rates using their tools, whether it be the Lucas, whether it be CodeStat or LifeNet software, or even things like their LifePak 20. Whatever the case may be, I want you to check it out. Head over to physio-control.com and check out all of the amazing tools to improve CPR for your facility and your own practice. That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.